Well, we've, in terms of the question you asked, I think I've got the gist of it. Insofar as there are obviously, there's a designation and then there's a zone, and you've got two lots of activities. You've got the airport related activities, which includes planes taken off and landing, you've got engine testing, helicopter flights, and that sort of thing, most of which have a generation of noise which is exponentially different to what other noise might be generated by other land use activities. So, I mean, I'm not sure the extent to which those other activities would sort of fill up the bucket, so to speak, and affect the air noise boundary.
Well, I suppose the other way to look at it, if the requiring authority were to uplift the designation, where would we be?
Right. So, I mean, the zone itself has got a noise control and is the same in the same way as any other zone. So all those air noises would disappear and you'd have to then rely on the noise rule in, for the zone, whatever it is. I'm referring to that rule of 17561, which is reads like the standard noise rule and excludes noises relating to aircraft noise activities managed through the designation.
Sorry, what was that reference again?
17561, maximum noise land based activities.
Thank you.
And this is a debate between 50 and 55 or Mr. Humps.
Yep. So, under your 17562, we would be being left with designation 2 ceased to exist.
Saying if the designation goes, but the zoning is still there.
The definition, you also have the definition of the case, yes, it does. The definition of airport activity means the land used wholly or partly for landing, departure, and surface movement of aircraft.
So you said the zoning is still land aircraft?
Yes.
Right.
That was what my point was.
So you've still got the air noise boundary.
Well, no, because
you haven't got compliance required.
No, requirement
the air rule.
Right.
This is the issue with mirror consistency between zone and designation.
I had a quick look at the designation. There's something like five pages of conditions attached, but
I didn't appreciate about someone different that if you uplift the designation, you could still land aeroplanes.
Mm.
And if you uplift the designation, you'd have the second largest commercial zone in Queenstown too, which is another thing perhaps worth thinking about. Do I understand the question?
Well, I mean, we have to make sure that the air noise boundary continued for airport, for aircraft related activities, irrespective of the designation.
Okay. So, from my legal, well, sorry, legal perspective.
And I haven't amended this account for that.
I just suggest there's a significant danger in allowing airport activity currently provided for by designation by way of zoning, and I expect that's not even the QAC's intention, but I think you take the point, it's possible. You would have to link, if you were going to do, you'd have to link it to the contours somehow, but I expect that issue you raised is a strong argument for not having the two providing the same full range of activities. So if the airport wants to land aeroplanes, it needs a designation. I'll put it that way. Now we'll go back to the old fashioned view of designation, but I think we've had the discussion earlier. I don't know if that's helpful to you.
We didn't quite get the question. So at 5, I say that the proposed zone contains a policy supposedly seeking self-sufficiency within the airport for its supporting and complementary activities. Such a policy fails to acknowledge the already widespread nature of visitor economy within Frankton and wider Queenstown. I'll come back to comment a bit more on that when I look at the actual provisions, because I think it's worthwhile looking at the actual policy itself. While the proposed zone will extend the zone over an additional 100 hectares of land, much of this is taken up by airport runway and terminal apron areas. So the nature, extent and location of potential development and the manner in which it will integrate with the wider environment is unclear. Council Section 32 evaluation compares the status quo with an extended airport zone. It is agreed that the status quo, the rural zone, is inadequate. However, it does provide certainty as to airport activity, with airport-related activity to be provided within the existing, more limited airport mixed-use zone. The council should have considered existing neighbouring zones within Franklin Flats Specialty Zone and Remarkables Park Zone in terms of both the activities provided therein and the development controls pertaining to these zones. In relation to urban design, while acknowledging the non-regulatory proposal for an urban design guide for the airport, there are no objectives for what is to be achieved, for the wider environment, and the development controls are minimalist. In keeping with the neighbouring zones, I consider all new buildings should require a consent. In relation to traffic, the proposed airport zone has a number of disparate interfaces with the wider transport network around the airport. I mean, I characterise that in my evidence as sort of three potential usable areas. I mean, if you think of the airport and the runway and the cross runway, you've sort of got four quadrants, if you like, and the airport terminal itself is in the southwest. You've got an area of land adjacent to the event centre. You've got an area of land adjacent to Franklin Flats, specialty activity areas, G&E, mainly G, and then you've got another area on the southeast adjacent to the Marcus Park. So they were all quite different in the way that they, clearly those sub areas are not all going to be connected back to the terminal through some sort of internal roading system, because there simply isn't the room for that. So they'll all be accessed from different areas, and the traffic implications of that for a start, all of these zones that apply to those areas are all quite different. So in keeping with the neighbouring zones, I consider all new development beyond the terminal environs should have parking requirements, and more significant trip generators should require consent. So I'll come back to that point again, looking at the suggested changes. In relation to the nature, extent and location of potential development, I consider that in addition to visitor accommodation named above, the location of retail and commercial activities beyond the immediate environs of the airport terminal is inappropriate. So for clarity again, the immediate terminal environments, I think, is that southwest quadrant, not the other ones. In relation to the potential to make visitor accommodation more appropriate within the airport mixed-use zone through either a maximum length of stay or elimination of outdoor enjoyment areas, as suggested by Mr. Kyle, I consider that such restrictions are either impracticable in resource management terms or fail to deliver on appropriate standards of amenity for visitors. Mr. Young commented on that. Just thinking about this maximum length of stay, now, as I understand, it's clearly meant to sort of differentiate this accommodation in some way from other accommodation in the local area. And perhaps it's to differentiate it for sort of transit purposes or maybe weather's closed in or something like that. So there is this convenient visitor accommodation that people could go to. Commissioner Rogers raised the Christchurch example. I mean, I'm not familiar with that, but if in fact it's right there sitting on the end of the terminal, then I could imagine that you could have this accommodation that you wouldn't even leave the terminal. You just go into the hotel and fly the next day, and then you walk out. And so you're not actually exposed to the noise environment. And I think that could work. But it would be fairly limited. And then thinking through the way that would then have to operate, those rooms would have to be available. So some rooms would have to be kept vacant. You're starting to get into sort of commercial operational terms that I'm not really expert in, but they don't seem that practicable to me. That's not the way hotels would want to operate. And another sort of provision, if it was in any of the other quadrants, then you've got to leave the environs at the terminal, you've got to travel there. And if that's the case, then this convenience factor disappears, doesn't it? You might as well go beyond the air noise boundary to somewhere that's more convivial and I would say in resource management terms actually fits the objective of a memorable and attractive gateway to the district much better in terms of a visitor experience. If you're a transit visitor and you have to stay overnight, or the weather's closed and you have to stay an extra night, then that accommodation in the terminal would seem fair enough. But otherwise, it doesn't really seem to fit with the this broader aspect of providing for visitors to Queenstown in an appropriate way. And on that, I also note the inconsistency between Mr. Kyle, Mr. Day, and Ms. As to the maximum stay in this regard. And I say, in any event, even a short, very short stay maximum is not justifiable in resource management terms. So overall, I consider that a more rigorous approach to development control will achieve the objective of a memorable and attractive gateway to the district. Just going to my attachment with the zone changes. So when I got to the end of my main brief evidence, I was very aware of the fact that I'd made some suggestions that would be more helpful if I actually articulated that a bit more. So just going through those. The first one is I'm suggesting that policy 7213 about zoning sufficient land should be deleted. And if you think about that, I mean, these policies are meant to in some way help you in a resource consent scenario. But that policy doesn't help anything. I mean, if you've zoned all the airport land, you've already done it. I remember that the original guide put out by MFE back in 1994 about drafting your deficit policies, and one of the things was it said the policy is not, don't just have a policy that does something, that sees something that the plan does anyway. Well, if the plan's going to own all the land, you don't need that. It's not helping. So I don't see how that can, and it doesn't really meet the objective. Those first two policies are what you need. They meet the objective that's set out there, 17.3.1. The second bit of reading, down at 17.2.3, I've suggested some changes to that objective. Just over at the top of the next page, there's a couple of reasons I set out. Firstly, the current objective uses the words requirements. Obviously, it's unclear as to what the requirements of airports are. And there's also potential confusion with the notice of requirements. So I think the word requirements is unfortunate there. I suggest that you actually just start off the policy, the objective, by saying airport activities and airport related activities are provided for things down one of the airports, etc. The second reason is the point that I make in my evidence about acceptable levels of amenity. And I've split up levels of amenity between noise and other general levels of amenity there in the objective by saying that the objective should be to maintain acceptable a level of amenity for noise, but otherwise high levels of general amenity for those using the airports and for those residing on neighbouring land should be what we're aiming for. I think it's a bit more aspirational in terms of an area that's contributing a lot to visitor experience in Queenstown. So there I'm talking about urban design and the traffic experience and all those other sorts of things that contribute to amenity. That takes me through to the rules at 17.5. So I've got a couple of extra rules there. The first one is at 17.4.1b, which, notwithstanding what's in 17.4.1, it says that any airport activity and airport-related activity is permitted, provided it complies with the standards. I would restrict that further by saying that retail and commercial services, not within the immediate environs of the airport terminal facility, should be non-compliant. So they become a bit of a subset to what's provided for as a permitted activity in 17.4.1. At 17.4.1c, this is the controlled activity rule in relation to buildings. It's similar to the sort of thing that exists already in Activity Area D in the Franklin Flats zone, and also picks up on some of the things that matters for control in Activity Area 8 and the Remarkables Park zone. But I'd particularly draw your attention to over the page a matter of control being effects on visual amenity when viewed from and beyond the zone boundary. And in particular, I've put consideration of the provision of a view shaft from Hawthorne Drive across the eastern end of the runway. In the Franklin Flat Zone, there are these view shafts that operate from State Highway 6 mainly through the activity area C1 and C2. And so there was a lot of evidence on that in Plan Change 19 about retaining these view shafts so that the near field wasn't blocked from the highway for a view further into the distance. And it strikes me that as you come down Hawthorne Drive, before it does that curve around the end of the airport, there is a point at which I think a similar view shaft should operate straight off the end. It can be the same dimension as the ones that are in the Franklin Flat Zone.
So you mean the western end?
The eastern end.
It's seems
Shot over Riverine.
This seems the westerly divide.
Yes, the Shot over in east end.
Oh, so the Shot over in.
Yes.
No road there yet.
So you're talking about the road that isn't there.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Right.
Yes.
And what is the view shaft to?
Well, if you go by the height of buildings.
Now, what is the view of along
this? Oh, similar to, I've looked at it in the sort of big scale, similar to the view shafts that apply within the Franklin Flax Zone at the moment. They're angled up at the Remarkables.
Mm. The padding, which might be looking at the Remarkables, is it looking at Coronet Peak or is it the Crown Range? Or
you're going to be looking the back way. As you come from.
The northern side of the runway.
Yes, so you're on the northern side of the runway.
Right.
Yes,
that's not clear from there.
Yes, oh, I apologise. Yes.
In terms of lot 6,
I see.
To the bait.
Yes.
Where you were coming from, the other way around, yes, you would be looking at the Crown Range and others, but it's a policy of Remarkable Park Zone about use of those. And the difficulty we have is no one's thought about that. You know, that's how we look about what a memorable view is from a particular point that's worth preserving. But we're trying to meet those objectives and policy on either side. These kind of things, but I take the point where, who's going to tell us where it is and for what. And I would suggest that perhaps not our job, but we have made a recommendation.
No, I just want clarity of, because no, I was thinking of getting the other way around rather than.
Actually, I did skip over that first one. The judge in the lot six decision, where the decision talked about decision. At the end of that paragraph 19 and 4 out of the decision, the judgment said we agree also with Dr. Reed that a linear pattern of development along the 1 kilometre boundary with the balance of RPZ would be a new and notable pattern within the landscape, and without litigation was neither pleasant nor attractive. So I picked up on that in this control being reserved in relation to the design and appearance, and in particular the avoidance of lineal patterns of development. I've also picked up on the regular offset from the edge of the runway strip. So, given those quadrants I was talking about, you've got this bit of land next to AAD and another bit of land next to Remarkables Park, AAA, they're quite long. That's the nature of them. So, there could be the potential for a road going along there, and you've just got these sort of buildings just sort of regularly offset from them. And that's what I understand to be an unfortunate urban design result as per the evidence given to the court in that case. So with buildings being a controlled activity, that would give the council an opportunity just to see how those buildings might be forming taking place within that area. And of course, I don't know how those areas of land are going to be accessed. It's all a bit unclear. Moving on to the next few changes, there were obviously different points of view about in the planning evidence about the appropriate heights and building setback. I've looked at the alternatives in the other zones around there, and I'm suggesting that the setback goes to 5 metres. It's been more consistent with neighbouring zones, and also the height being 9 metres has been more consistent with neighbouring zones. over the page to 17561. That rule's been reinstated, whereas the council's section 42A report suggests that it struck out. And Mr. Hunt recommends those changes.
What could we do with the exactly the same rule in chapter 36? That, I think that was the reason that the section 42A report said remove it, because it's repeated in chapter 36.
Well, this is the noise rule for the zone, and
well, chapter 36 has the noise rule for the zone too.
Right.
Yes. And I'm happy to hear the submissions of evidence on it now, but I suppose the question is, should it be in chapter 36, which has all the noise rules for all the zones,
right,
or should it be in this zone and not in chapter 36? We shouldn't have them both, should we?
Well, sir, I'm sorry, I'm not appraised of the scheme of the plan so much in terms of these required rule approaches.
Okay, so put it this way.
Yes.
Is it your evidence that whatever noise rules are applied, they're these ones?
Yes.
No matter where they go.
Yes. I mean, I'm quite happy and okay with the district wide approach to noise. You go to that chapter and you find your noise rules. That's fine.
Yeah. Okay, that's good.
And of course, Mr. Hunt has recommended those changes. In terms of the daytime, nighttime noise limits. So that then takes us down to the strike through for the visitor accommodation provision within the air noise boundary, as per Mr. Hunt's evidence and my comments. Over the page, I picked up on the car parking and other transport related rules or lack of them. So the council does have a rule that activities, their words were activities undertaken in association with the airport terminal facility are exempt from complying with any minimum parking requirements. I'm not changing that. I just think that in association with the airport terminal is a bit loose. That doesn't connote a geographic limit to me.
Yeah.
Maybe you might say immediate environments of the airport terminal is a bit loose as well, but I mean, it could be mapped. If you agree with the approach, you could actually have a map that just sort of puts a dotted line around it. So there's a minor change there. So, but beyond that, obviously we do have minimum car parking rules. And I'm suggesting that those rules be the same as what currently applies within the Fractal Specialty Zone, which has maximums and minimums specified. I'm also saying that, and this is an approach also in the Frankton Flat Zone, which is taken to controlling some more of a traffic management rule. So that where a site has more than 15 car parks for visitors and or staff, then obviously it's generating some level of trip demand, and so beyond a certain level, there should be some assessment as to the effect of that. Otherwise, you could, from these disparate areas, you can have quite a lot of trip generation from various activities going off into the network, and elsewhere, the approach of the district plan is that trip generation is assessed.
So are you there concerned about the effect on the capacity of the roading network?
Yes. So if you're a small activity, or if you're not a high trip generator, like for example, most warehousing type activities or airport logistics or something like that would probably not trigger this rule. I mean, there's other ways of doing it, but that's the technique that's adopted in the Franklin Flat Zone. And I said, I've just got an idea of mass pulp control.
I take it from this rule and a number of others, and your earlier comments, that in terms of the immediate terminal area, you're satisfied that the plan makes appropriate provision in the zone for the sort of activities that would should occur in that immediate vicinity, and that the bulk of your concerns, ignoring the setbacks and the height limit, are in respect of those other three quadrants,
yes,
where there's land of the airport that adjoins other land and is disconnected from the terminal. Is that?
That's right. I mean, I read the evidence in support of the rule about car parking in relation to the terminal, and because you've got such a combination of activities there, it seemed to make sense to me that that it was very difficult to say what the minimum parking requirements would be.
Mm. Certainly more than they are now.
I have read some other stuff about the fact that there was a bit of spillover of car parking and etc. out into the nearby suburbs. I haven't got evidence on that. So,
the reason I ask that question is because, as I understand the submission and the was really that the extension of the zone from what is operative isn't part of the cause of these concerns. It's in the operative zone is focused on the terminal area and that area between Hawthorne Drive and the street that runs around to it. And that the remainder is zoned, underlying zoning is in the operative plan, rural general. So, in part, would a lot of your concerns be dealt with if the zoning remained a similar pattern to the operative plan?
Yes.
Right. Yes.
I mean, I have made the statement that I think the rural zone seems not fit.
Well, that was my next question. If we didn't have the rural zone as the underlying zone, and given your earlier I think acceptable approach to designation is that the underlying zoning might reflect what the council may wish if the designation was uplifted, what would you see as an appropriate zoning on that remaining land then?
Well, a lot of the airport related activities, not your retail and your commercial, those sorts of things, but a lot of the airport related sort of warehousing type, logistic type activities, would probably fall within the definition of industrial activities, which are permitted in the activity area D and E1 and Franklin Flats. I mean,
you have to excuse me, but I've been lucky. I haven't had to deal with Franklin Flats.
So
you can humour me by explaining.
Yeah, those two activity areas are the industrial.
Right.
Activity areas. So they don't provide for activities which would have any reverse sensitivity effect to the airport. They do provide for land that was identified as being generally in demand in Franklin. I mean, obviously there was general view that retail and commercial should be, you know, limited to other parts of the Franklin Plate Special area, and it was in those areas for the airport reasons and the airport concern. It was very strong, you know, submitter along those lines, and that restriction should be there. So I mean, I could see that zoning just simply coming down to the edge of the runway, whatever's needed.
But this information was uplifted, of course, the runway isn't there either.
No.
So would you take that industrial zoning to the runway? What would you have on the other side of it?
On the southern side?
Well, yes, from the runway, from the edge of the industrial.
Across the runway or on the other side of the runway?
Well, both. You said the industrial land would come down from the north to the runway.
Yes. Thought about that, but perhaps I could come in from the south. Clearly, activity area 8 in the Remarkables Park Zone again reflects its proximity to the airport. It only provides for recreational activities, utilities, and what's it called?
Rural
activities. So it applies to very little, in fact. But that zone also reflects the fact that there's residential down near the Colorado River area. So, I think really my answer is if you're going to look at rezoning there, I think you need to do a proper study and see what the needs are. And if you haven't done that, despite what I said about rural, maybe the rural becomes a good holding position in the absence of looking at what the different needs for different activities are within that part of Franklin.
The other thing that struck me from your discussion of these issues that concern you, would they be somewhat ameliorated if the airport company had some sort of management plan for their entire property that could be linked to the zoning with indications of what activities could occur in which area?
Definitely, because those quadrants have, I think I've already said, those quadrants have different environments. They have a common environment, sure, which is the airport. But as you go beyond them, they all have different environments, which they need to have some respect to and relate to. And a management plan of that type could recognise those different environments and respond to it. I think there would be some commonalities of what was provided for. But then you'd probably find that the airport terminal area would be more would be the place where a wider range of activities could happen.
Is that sort of approach taken at other airports in your experience?
The precincts, I mean, you've got to appreciate Auckland Airport's 1,000 hectares, so it's large. I mean, as you probably know, there's an existing runway, there's a new runway to the north. In between that, there are there's an area that's less affected by noise. That whole thing is a core sub-precinct, and then there are other precincts that relate to the coastal edge and an interface with the industrial area to the north, where other things are provided for. So I wouldn't say that's a management plan, but it is a planning approach that recognises the different environments that affect what can happen around the airport.
I'll just take you to Mr. Carl's evidence in paragraph 517, and this is back on the issue of the visitor accommodation.
That was paragraph 517?
517 on page 12. And you see there, he's got his airport-related activities defined in the VDP, and he's supportive of that. And the words there, with the needs of airport passengers. So we've talked a bit around that. So do you see, you've been talking about the difficulty of monitoring and enforcing. Do you think those words in any way help that particular circumstance about that issue of use of visitor accommodation?
I think they are an attempt to confine the provision of those activities in some ways.
So you think that they would you sort of interpret them to the effect that a person who has no connection at all with being an airport passenger then would be somehow prevented from utilising the visitor accommodation?
In practice, I can't see how that would
work.
No. I just wonder with those words, how far up through that definition do they apply as well? Do you read down all those activities as being qualified in that way?
I just read it for the latter part, and visitor accommodation associated with the needs of airport passengers. But yeah, I take your point.
So it's just. Yes, and my answer there stands. It comes down to a matter of enforcement and interpretation. I can't see how it would work in practice.
Now, am I right in thinking that, if you like, when we think about other airports, Auckland you've already commented upon, and you sort of draw a distinction between airport at Auckland and Queenstown by talking about the different size, the availability of land at Auckland compared to Queenstown. That's a distinguishing factor that might support different approaches and different treatments of the two airports.
Yes, I mean,
I understand that. And Christchurch Airport, you may not be so familiar, but that possibly fits into a similar but slightly different category in that it's some distance per se from the city area, and it's got a large area of land around it that it, can I use the word, controls, owns. And it's managed to aggregate a range of related activities around it. So in comparison, Queenstown's, in terms of a context, is quite different. It's quite constrained in terms of the actual land it controls, if you like.
Yes.
And then that leads to these issues of possibly, potentially trying to sort of pigeonhole these related airport activities into too little land.
Yes, but then the other thing there is that at Christchurch, obviously with a lot of rural land around it, you don't have these alternatives. And I'm thinking of visitor accommodation, you don't have these other alternatives, so they've responded to that in a different way.
Yeah. By sort of bringing them on campus, if
that's right. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. I had the Christchurch circumstance in mind, particularly when I was reading your paragraph 5.6, and you're critical there of the import company not considering alternatives beyond its boundaries. And import companies, I'm not sure that they'd be renowned for considering options on other people's lands. And I was just trying to sort of draw some, distinguishing features by way of context in my mind. And that's obviously a, a fairly clear one, where these other airports, perhaps with the exception of Wellington, they have the luxury of more land, so they can aggregate these other ancillary or related activities on site.
Yes, yeah, I mean, I'm certainly okay with the activity, if I can call it that, of the Auckland International Airport and trying to constrain activities that they actually do provide within their vast acreages. I mean, you know, people have commented on their balance sheet, and they call on sort of one of the biggest, you know, property owning companies. That's, you know, more of their turnover and it comes from property than airport activity.
Yes.
Yeah. And so that's the nature of the beast, isn't it?
Yeah. But again, in terms of context, they're separated. They're some distance from available alternatives. That's the point I take.
Yes.
To remind that the airport companies are, of course, quite comfortable restricting adjoining land through contours or whatever else, but not, perhaps you made the point of utilising it. That's one of the issues for us, to raise the suspicions of the limiting of use.
Round out the conversation you were having with the chair, your paragraph 713, particularly was testing your thoughts around, well, what would the appropriate zoning be if we didn't have an airport zone? And you conclude in paragraph 713, you say, in other words, the PDP does not need to zone land for airport purposes. So can you just expand on that?
Yes, I'm saying that for true airport purposes, you rely on a designation.
Yeah.
You don't need to go zoning for that, because you've got that power as a requiring authority. What you do need the zoning for what the perceived need of the zoning is for airport-related activities, and that comes back to that sufficiency argument that I had. When you're looking at that, what is sufficient, and where else is that provided for, and the council hasn't looked at that. So that then goes back to the need for the zoning itself.
Yeah. And that's something Mr. Young raised in his submissions about an element of Section 32 to have a look at alternatives.
Experience as a planner. We have in this proposal two definitions of airport activity, one for Queenstown Airport, one for Wellington Airport, and two definitions of airport related activity, one for Wellington Airport and one for Queenstown Airport. In your view, is such duplication appropriate, or should the plan definitions be more general and then through the standards deal with the specifics as they may apply at each airport?
I don't think I'm au fait enough with the needs and requirements of Wellington Airport to understand why there's been a differentiation.
Okay. Could I ask it slightly differently then? Your experience in Auckland. Does the Auckland plan provide a different definition of airport activities for the Auckland International Airport as opposed to Article Recro? You may not know.
Can I? I don't know. Then I don't know that.
Yeah.
I would suspect not. But if I could answer that,
I'm happy for you to answer in writing.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
That would
be helpful to you if that was it.
Yeah. Mm. Other than that, thank you. Something very, very well.
Thanks. I'll now call Jim Carter to address the Queenstown Wharves submission. It relates to the Queenstown County in the waterfront subzone.
Yes.
Focused on three key issues for the Queenstown waterfront zone. Firstly, the zoning. The submission and then my evidence proof on that was that the zoning was shown clearly on the planning map. And when I looked into this further in drafting up my evidence, I recognised that the Queenstown waterfront zone is actually comprised of three different areas. And that's referenced in the rules, but that doesn't flow through to the objectives of policies. Secondly, that the provisions have been transferred across from the operative plan and don't recognise or provide for the resource management issues faced now by the Queenstown waterfront zone for now and into the future. And thirdly, that the provisions provide no support for passenger ferry services. At section 7 of my primary evidence, I suggested an amended set of provisions that I consider better address the resource management issues faced by the Queenstown waterfront subzone. Then, having read the evidence of Ms. Fiona Black, lodged on behalf of Real Journeys Limited, I realised that she talked also about co-location services, and she finds that co-locating the services creates undue congestion and unnecessary time pressures. Ms. Black has operational experience, and I therefore rely on her expertise in that regard. And from a planning perspective, it is important to manage potential adverse effects from fuel storage and servicing, and to that end, locating those facilities at one location could be preferable. However, as Ms. Black states, this needs to be balanced with ensuring that the facility can operate effectively and efficiently. And I agree with Ms. Black in paragraph 3.11 that the proliferation of structures within the Queenstown Bay and Queenstown Garden shoreline will have adverse effects on views. The purpose of my amendments to the provisions is to recognise the different values associated with the three areas within the Queenstown waterfront zone, provide a greater level of direction, and better enable passenger ferry services. In my primary evidence, I provided a rules table which gives the numbering of the proposed plan and shows the suggested changes that either strike through or underline. I've summarised the changes in the following table in my summary. In the left-hand column, I list the rules in the proposed district plan. In the centre, I identify the proposed change that I provided in my primary evidence, and in the right-hand column, I provide an explanation. And I've grouped the rules as follows. Commercial activities on jetties, wharves and land, commercial activities on the surface of water, jetties and wharves and buildings. And I just provided that summary just to show you that the changes aren't actually significant, and also by grouping those activities, I hope to provide some greater clarification, because by using just the proposed district plan numbering system, it's quite disjointed. So I thought it would be easy to group the activities together. But I guess, in conclusion, I started the evidence on the basis of looking at provision for passenger ferry services within the Queenstown waterfront zone, and having looked into it in more detail, I realised that that there's key resource management issue that I don't think is being addressed in the waterfront zone, and it sort of leads to a need to really look at those provisions that apply in a more broad sense.
Okay.
So just picking up the point about the ferry service, what you're driving at there is you want to provide some space or opportunity for a ferry service which is yet to be established? Or?
That's right. Well, at the moment there's the Queenstown Water Taxi operates. At the moment that's the only ferry service that's in place, and it is fairly limited. I know that Remarkables Park has the ability to provide a jetty in their zone on the Caldwell River, and that there's a policy specifically within Remarkables Park zone to provide for that and to support that. And I do know too that there's been a plan for quite some time to try and provide a passenger ferry service. One of the key reasons that the wharves here at Queenstown were purchased was to enable that to be provided. And so when I looked at the provisions for within the Queenstown waterfront zone, I realised that there's no mention of supporting passenger ferry services in the policies, and then if they were to be provided, then any building or structure on the wharf would be non-compliant. And having sort of seen what the consents that have been approved over the past few years for other activities within the Queenstown waterfront zone, I mean, there is a concern that the available space could be taken up with other activities, and that could lead to the inability to provide a passenger ferry service.
The space alongside the wharf, is that not really just a commercial issue in terms of getting access to that space, paying for it?
That is one of the issues, but I think one of the other issues is congestion and safety. So, having read Ms. Black's evidence about the Urns Law, I think that sort of raises the issue of if you're going to have these large vessels coming in and out, you do need to ensure that there's safety and that they can all come into the same place. It's quite a finite resource. When you look out here, it's already what I term active frontage is already fairly full. I can't see how you could actually fit any more wharves in there. If there's already boats that have been consented and operating, then you do have to consider how a passenger ferry service could operate within there in a safe manner.
Some of those issues dealt with though in terms of sort of navigation rules and regulations and matters of that sort?
Yes. But those are considered alongside the district plan, I think. And having been involved in some of the resource consent issues on the Caldwell River with between KJET and Thunderjet, those were key issues there, both under the maritime safety but also under the district plan. And ensuring safety comes out of both.
Now, just a point of clarification for me, figure one in your evidence, this is the figure you use to identify these three different areas. Is that a figure or a plan that I'd actually find in either the operative or the proposed plan?
So, that's the figure that I prepared myself. I took it from Council GIS system, and what you see there is Council GIS that shows the overlay of the district plan zonings. The lines that I've added are coloured lines that link to the keys that I've provided.
And do you think, is it your view that the linkage between figure one and the amendments that you propose is to be preferred than what's currently proposed in them?
What I've tried to do is provide a bit more clarity, because at the moment the rules that are proposed refer to these different areas in text form, and it's quite difficult to find out exactly where they go when you look at the plan. And I noticed that Ms. Jones, in her evidence that she's tabled this week, she recognised the issue of there seems to be a bit of a loophole with the Queenstown Harbour shoreline. So what I was trying to do here was simply clarify what's used in the rules already and show that on the district plan. And I think that the planning maps would benefit from having that.
And is it your understanding that there is agreement or commonality about these three different areas that you've identified?
Yes, there is, in that they're already referred to in the district plan. However, I've termed them in my own way. I don't know if there's agreement as to how I've termed them. That was just my thought of how they could be.
So leaving the descriptor aside, actually where they are, is that understood, commonly agreed?
Yes, well, yes. I mean, between St. Omer Park and Town Pier, that's definitely consistent. However, there is a bit of a discrepancy in the Queenstown Beach area versus the Queenstown Garden shoreline, in that one of the rules refers to, I think it's between the town pier and the Queenstown Gardens, and there's then an initial rule where did the Queenstown Gardens start. So between the gardens and the Queenstown Pier could actually just be the Queenstown Beach.
Do you think that would be clearer if it was the mouth of Horn Creek?
Yes.
All right, thank you.
Yes, thanks. Just in your paragraph 6.5. Your first bullet point mentions opportunities to provide transport connections, passenger transport connections, and that there's no incentive to provide such services. Is that because of the lack of, I guess, clarity in terms of how that would actually be achieved as opposed to actually proposing an incentive? And if it was an incentive, what is it?
Well, at the moment, there's no differentiation between a charter vessel versus a passenger ferry service. And given that there's a finite resource there, I would think it would be useful to provide some policy support towards a passenger ferry service over and above a charter vessel. So when you look at the background documents that the Council's prepared, the transportation strategy and the duties and warranty policy, and then the town centre strategy, we're all talking about using the lake as a public transport option. And so in my view, that should be supported in the policy so that, and that can be seen as an incentive. So you know, if you're providing that service, that's given more support than another boating activity that takes up space that could otherwise be used for passenger ferries.
So incentivized through additional weighting on passenger transport.
That's right.
Over the bus.
Yeah. Yes. Great. Okay.
Just looking at your draft rules that start on page 11, on page 13, passenger ferry service. You're suggesting there that it be a restricted discretionary activity. How does that mesh up with the requirements in the rural zone, which applies to the rest of the surface of the lake?
I'd have to check that.
It's a discretionary activity, I think. Yeah. That's what I was asking, is there any value in it being restricted discretionary within the Queenstown Basin when you get past the point there as discretionary?
I guess what I was trying to do was to provide that differentiation between the passenger ferry coming into the Queenstown Bay versus another application for a charter boat, say.
Right.
So, again, it's trying to provide some more support for it within this finite resource in here, and also recognising that this is the location where it should berth and where passengers should get on and off, because this is the area where it can be absorbed from an amenity perspective.
Yes, is that the point? Is the berthing the critical factor that maybe you're aiming at? So.
That's right, yeah. I don't think it affects so much of the ferry coming in and out.
On the previous page, the your 12.4.7.3, just unclear whether you were meaning one building or any number, provided they didn't exceed one story.
Well, I put a single story, so yeah, going like that, it would be the one. And then I guess, what is that one building per wharf? I guess what I was trying to provide for was that if you're going to provide a passenger ferry service, then you will likely need a ticketing facility and also shelter. And I thought about whether that could be a controlled activity, but given the importance of maintaining the views across the wharves, from footpath, I think restricted discretion is probably a better activity status for it, to make sure that the buildings are fairly small in size and they're safe. If there's any shelter, that it's potentially glass, so that it can still be entered.
But the other question I had was, in your summary you talk about this issue of co-location of services and referred to Ms. Black's evidence. In a practical sense, given that you identified that between Sonoma Park and the town wharf is the only activity area where it can happen, where else could you have any services located?
Well, I'm not a boating person, but I understand.
Unfortunately, that falls to us planners to sometimes come up with this, because we're not boating people.
I guess where I was coming from was that, from a planning perspective, I think that logically it should be in one place, and at present I understand it's at St. Ivan Wharf. But if that's problematic operationally, then maybe that's some other area.
Is it problematic for the land-based side, but if you're going to have fuel dispensing, you have to be able to get tankers for it.
It would be. I'd suggest that St. Ivan Wharf is probably the only one that would have decent access on the boat. I'm not sure how many of the boats actually do fuel in town anyway. I know KTX and Co, they go through
to the marina
and Franklin. And also maybe that's something that needs to be thought about as well, given that the limited space in here in the town centre, whether that those are appropriate activities and whether it should be limited.
I think what you're saying is more work needs to be done on what happens there.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for your time. Please, anything more for me, and I don't think we're really done, so I appreciate the patience of time.
And we're doing it until 10 a.m. tomorrow morning.